Tonight, on the first installment of Agents of Cool Debrief, we interview Merle M. Rasmussen, better known in gaming circles simply as The Administrator. Back in 1980, he created the very first espionage role-playing game, Top Secret. And now, after 30 years, he has come back in from the cold with a brand new spy RPG game design for the 21st century, Top Secret New World Order. It's gotten a spectacular start on Kickstarter, and tonight we're talking to the man himself on Agents of Cool.
Merle, we are really tickled to have you on the show tonight. We've got, between me and Ray and Stacy, we are, in addition to being huge fans of spy movies and TV shows, we're also longtime tabletop role players.
Well, obviously, if you've heard of Top Secret, the game was out from February 1980 to 1987, sold 214,000 copies in English-speaking countries around the world, and they hired me to work for them for 22 months, TSR. They downsized me. After 22 months, I went, how should we put it, on a hiatus for 30 years. And now I've been rediscovered. So that's the short version of my life.
But excellent.
Every life has two acts, and this is my second act.
Well, as fans of your game, sir, we're very happy for it.
Well, it has been remarkable. Just before airtime tonight, I looked at the Kickstarter, and we're at $66,074 from 941 backers. I didn't do the math, but I'd say that's about $720 per backer average.
Wow.
And it has blown away the expectations of the younger marketing people. And I say younger. Alan Hammack is older than me. He's my editor. And he used to be my boss at TSR, which is very funny.
Of course, the new company is also TSR.
Yes. The old company wasn't using it anymore. And so the new company took over the TSR, and nobody cares. I will tell you one funny. Someone asked if TSR stood for Top Secret Rules, which it does not. But I thought it was rather clever, actually.
It's certainly appropriate. And speaking as old-time tabletop role-playing gamers, we are kind of tickled to see those initials back in play, too.
Well, they were bought by Wizards of the Coast, and then Wizards of the Coast was bought by whatever big toy company.
Hasbro.
And the funny part is, nobody was using TSR or Top Secret Espionage Role-Playing Game. They never did anything with it.
Well.
And so, both TSR and the name Top Secret are available. Also, Top Secret is an American lexicon. It doesn't belong to anybody. You can have Top Secret cat litter. I mean, you know, you can have cats. And there is Top Secret cat litter.
That's got to be better than the old yellow dog food I saw the other day.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Exactly. But the point is, we decided New World Order would tell people it's a new game, it's the 21st century, and it will not be confused with the original Top Secret or Top Secret SI, Special Investigations. By calling it Top Secret New World Order, it also harkens to a new generation that's never heard of me and has never played an espionage role-playing game. So we've upped the game into the 21st century. Instead of the Cold War with the Americans versus the Soviets, we are now in the war against terror, the war against drugs, the war against bad guys ruling the world. We're in a new situation where there aren't two superpowers anymore. So it makes for an interesting play. And then I had to create a new organization called ICON, the International Covert Operations Network.
Oh, good
which
acronym.
Is actually ICON.
Good I-C-O-N. Acronym. I like that.
Well, we have a committee, a design group, and the first one we did, they didn't like my first acronym, so we got rid of it. And right now we're bouncing between International Covert Operations Network and International Clandestine Operations Network because we keep changing it. So that's where we're at. Anyway, this organization, the United Nations sends out armies to keep warring factions apart. and they create demilitarized zones, such as in between the Koreas and other places of the world, and they're there forever. And so the premise is you send secret agents into these areas of conflict to prevent war in the first place. That's my premise. How do you like that? That's a simple premise. And because it's a secret arm of the United Nations, they have secret funding, and the agents are coming, and the resources are coming secretly from multiple nations around the world. So you can be on a team of agents from anywhere, Russia, India, Great Britain, United States, working together to solve a world problem, such as pot poachers in South America, or financing terrorism in the sub-Saharan Africa, or other nefarious activities. The problem comes when you discover your home country is one of the bad guys behind the action, and you have to choose loyalty sometime. I've had Russians that discovered that Russia was behind the takeover of a government in northern Chad. This is all fictitious. And he had to choose between ICON and his home country. It resulted in an awful gun battle between players. So it's a wonderful plot device.
Yeah, I like that as a setup.
Yeah, it's a setup. But I have been asked by TSR, Jason Elliott is the publisher. And Mr. Elliott is a fan of Top Secret from his teenage years. He also produced Gygax magazine for 6 issues. He asked me to write a Top Secret module for his magazine. I was telling him about Omicron, and a single teenager came to see me at a seminar, and they stayed for an hour, and I called him up to the table to talk to him. And he said, yeah, that was me.
Wow.
So Jason Elliott and I have a long relationship. Alan Hammack, the editor, he and I have had a relationship from at least 1982. Actually, I should say before that, because he was the editor of the original Top Secret. It was published in February of 80, so we knew each other in the 70s. The other gentleman, James Carpio from the East Coast, is more of the designer of the combat system, which we call the Lucky 13 engine. And then we have Chad Parrish from the Chicago area. Chad came up with a whole bunch of what I used to call areas of knowledge, technical intelligence, signal intelligence, different forms of information that the agent would know. Also is the author of the first module in the box called White Queen. So he's also involved with the Dead Game Society. He's one of the founding members. So he is interested in the new Top Secret.
What is the Dead Game Society?
Dead Game Society, if the game is out of print, they have a group of people that play them at conventions.
Ah.
These people are called the Dead Game Society, and they do have a website, but it's DGS something.
Okay.
It's very amusing. He comes at it from a different point of view because the game was out of print.
Right.
And so now we're debating whether the new Top Secret will be undead or resurrected, or if it's just a brand new game system.
Right.
So the new game is not compatible with
right,
the original.
Right.
It's all new. So that makes it's no longer a dead game.
Right, right.
Put it that way.
If you don't mind taking us back into the past somewhat, how did you get into the espionage genre as a youngster?
Well, you'll love this. I was raised on television and movie espionage. In those days, it was James Bond, Mission Impossible. There were TV shows like I Spy and It Takes a Thief.
All favorites of the show.
And Maxwell Smart and The Avengers. That's what I was raised on. Movies like James Bond, In Like Flint, those come to mind, but there are others.
You're singing our song, sir.
Yes. Well, that's why this is an interesting group to talk to. Instead of reading a lot of books, I was watching a lot of TV.
Mm-hmm.
And went off to college in 1975. And it happened to be that Dungeons and Dragons had come out in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And my longtime friend, James Thompson, said, hey, we're playing this at Iowa State University. Come over and play. It was October. They put my character in charge of pulling the mules through the dungeon as they collected treasure and put it in the mule backpack. My job was not to look at the treasure, but to keep the mules pulled forward. Well, after doing this for 2 different sessions of D&D, I decided that fantasy did not impress me, but role-playing inspired me.
Gotcha.
And so as a freshman at Iowa State University, I started developing, and as you may know, when you're 20, 21 years old, well, at the time I was 18 going on 19, trying to find myself. What are the roles of life? What am I going to be when I grow up? And so I was playing with different aspects, I think it just fell onto me that, you know, I could play a secret agent, and I could change my role, and I didn't know it till like the last year. Top Secret was the first game where the character plays a character. For example, you are all these gadgets and knowledge and abilities and weapons, and you play an ordinary person. It's very similar to being Superman and playing the part of Clark Kent.
Okay. Right, because you have cover identities and so forth.
Yes. So what I developed with my good friend James Thompson, we were playing one agent and one game master, and we're developing the rules for this, what we called Spy World, because there was already a game called Gamma World on the market. So after a year of playtesting, and I was now a sophomore at Iowa State, he said, hey, this is pretty good. You ought to send this to TSR. And I said, who's that? They're the people that published Dungeons and Dragons. So I sent them a query letter, and they said, yeah, we would like to look at this. So I sent them a photocopy, and they wrote back. And they said, I have a note here from Gary Gygax. We want to accept this manuscript as soon as it is typed. So I had sent them a copy of my handwritten work.
Aha! Uh-huh.
I then proceeded to hire typists, people that type, you know, doctoral dissertations and all that good stuff. But I went through three typists that kept quitting on me, and finally had a typed manuscript, made a photocopy, sent it off to TSR. They sent me a contract. And
wow.
It happened to be, I think I was a sophomore junior by that time in college. And they then pursued, the game went from Mike Carr in the contract stage to Alan Hammack. They threw it over the wall to him in the publication phase side of the company. And so I started getting letters from Alan Hammack, and we worked on the game for 3 years more till February of 80. Just prior to publication, they needed a module, and they sent me, I think it was G3, which is like Dungeons and Dragons or AD&D.
One of the Against the Giants.
Something like that, something. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know what this was. Then Mike Carr sent me a copy of B1, Into the Unknown, and I heavily plagiarized B1 and created the first espionage mission module, which is pronounced Operation Sprechenhalterstelle.
I've always wondered that.
Sprechenhalterstelle is the only three German words I knew at the time. Speaking stopping place. It's where people stop talking.
I like.
It was the strangest thing, because instead of monsters, we had human targets. And instead of magic, we had technology. And I had places you could make the game your own with random generated items that appeared in random places. And it worked. People understood. So we have the rules. We have Sprechenhalterstelle. They put it in a box. Came out for $10.
Wow.
After the first run, they raised the price to $12. And it stayed at $12 for the next probably 6 years. You asked where the idea came from. And I would say my upbringing and growing up with TV and movie espionage. I did read a few James Bond books along the way. And what else? I think it was part of my development as a young person to try new roles, try different things. And so part of that growth pattern when you're 18, 19, 20, I didn't realize that I was a writer. So discovering myself as a writer, I had to laugh. Went to the student counseling service, and they had me do a series of essays on what jobs have I had and what's the good and bad about them, what jobs would I like to have, what's good and bad about the future jobs. And when I went to be counseled, they said, would you mind if we used your essay answers for other students as an example for them to follow?
Wow.
Well, I didn't realize, but I was a writer. And as you have discovered, I also have a gift for gab. So you put those two together, and I also started writing for Dragon Magazine,
mm-hmm.
had the Rasmussen Files as a column.
I've read a few of those.
So I answered questions from the fans. And I was being buried in fan letters. And they were asking, like, what's the hand-to-hand weapon value for an outboard motor? You know, things like this.
A vitally important piece of information. No
Will
doubt.
The players surprise you?
Yeah, it makes good copy. The first year I was at Gen Con, mm-hmm. I was not happy at being at a group seminar. And it mm-hmm. showed, and I didn't know what I was doing there. The second year, I rocked. People were hilarious. They were laughing at my jokes, talking about Siamese attack cats and all kinds of things that had happened during playtest. And suddenly, I couldn't get through the lobby with my name tag on the first day. So the second day, I took my name tag off, and I could get to my events.
You were incognito.
Yes. And what I learned was at a very young age what fame is to a very limited market. This is pretty heady stuff for a young person. I mentioned that I also got downsized with 49 other people one day. I made it to the third cut at TSR. Mm-hmm. They said, it's nothing you did. We missed a $40 million sales prediction by $18 million.
Ew.
So we have to cut some people. I and Jim Ward were cut the same day.
Oh, wow.
Which is very odd. And I that reminds me, I had filed my game, Spy World, away and marked it in the file cabinet top secret.
Mm.
Mike Carr had filed it away at TSR and marked it top secret. We found this out, and we both said, that's the name. That's the name.
There
Meaning
you
we
go.
Both called it the Top Secret Project. It's top secret.
Makes sense.
And that worked. It was the great parallel development, and we went, that's the name. We're going with it.
That is awesome.
Well, Mike Carr and I also hit it off. I think I wound up at his apartment playtesting with a bunch of TSR people on one of the game conventions they had in Lake Geneva. And it must have been good enough. They had a local game club that managed to lose some of their campaign material. The public picked up the campaign material, read it, turned it over to the local police. The police read it, turned it over to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, who came to TSR to investigate who is William Weatherby and why is he being assassinated in Beirut, Lebanon.
Perfect.
Well,
yes, I was about to ask you about that. I'd heard
yes,
a little something about it.
Mike Carr got mm-hmm. to meet with the FBI agents, and he said, no, it's not real. It's a game we're developing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game. And the answer the FBI told him was, well, okay, this time. But I've
but the next time you kill somebody in Lebanon.
But the next time, but the next time,
yeah, next time you kill someone in Lebanon, we'll be back. Anyway, they said there is a poor FBI agent assigned to watch their company, and he sat in a parked car outside their building in Lake Geneva for a week. TSR turned it into a press release. The game so realistic it was investigated by the FBI.
Yeah.
Well, when they hand you publicity like that on a platter, you may as well use it.
And they did. They absolutely did. And I got a phone call about it, and I'm like, "What? What happened?"
It does speak well of the. And correct me if I mispronounce this. The verisimilitude.
Verisimilitude.
Yeah. Of the game.
You like that word?
I like that word. I can't say it, but I like it.
Well, Jason Elliott used that very word when he asked me if I could design a new espionage role-playing game, and it had to have verisimilitude to the real life.
Interesting.
Now, that's
Makes
the
sense.
Word he used. And what's funny is the game developed into a cinematic or gritty. You could go either way. It could be gritty realism or cinematic adventures. So we needed a game system that would appeal to both kinds of gamers or all kinds of gamers. And so they've come up with a tension track. They've come up with some interesting, and I say we as a design team have developed attribute dice, tradecraft dice, and asset dice. And instead of you having a fixed value for your attributes, nerve, suave, pulse, intellect, reflex, you have a die, D4, D6, D8, D10, D12.
Uh-huh.
You add those, if you're shooting at somebody, you're going to use your pulse die, and let's say it's a D6. And then you have a tradecraft die for signal intelligence, human intelligence, technical intelligence, or combat. So let's use a combat of D6. Sure.
All right.
And your asset die is your gun. So your gun might have, at this range, another D6. So now you've got 3D6 to roll. And you roll the 3D6 and try to get 13 or better. So there is a chance you can miss, but there's also a good chance you're going to hit. So this Lucky 13 engine was developed by the team, but it came from James Carpio.
Uh-huh.
And we loved it. So you're using three dice to roll 13 or better. And that is that's the easiest way to describe the Lucky 13 game engine.
I was wondering.
Then we also have little modifiers like burst and blowback.
Uh-huh.
And a burst is when you roll the highest number on an attribute die. You roll again and add the result,
uh-huh.
and the tension track goes down by one. But blowback is when you roll a one on an attribute die, and your character is saddled with a dilemma, and the tension track increases by one. Blowback, you actually subtract the die you roll from your attribute.
Uh-huh.
So burst and blowback are nasty things and make the game very cinematic. Things can go very well or things can go very badly for an agent.
How does that tension track work?
Well, the Lucky 13 is where you start the game.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you start having failures and blowbacks, bad
mm-hmm.
rolls. You then move the tension track to the number 14.
Uh-huh.
Now you have the three dice to roll, but you have to get a 14 or better to succeed at a tradecraft task. If it gets worse, then you're at 15 and 16 and 17, and so you're getting worse and worse and worse.
Wow.
I think we only go up to 18, fortunately. 18's as bad as it can get.
That'd be pretty bad.
Well, and this whole system was worked out, and it works. We're, like, enjoying this. Then you can also have good things. The burst can happen,
mm-hmm.
and then the tension track goes back down from 18 to 17 to 16 to 15 to 14. Back to Lucky 13. And I suppose, well, let's put it this way. You may have background talents, impairments. Those things can also add to the success of a die roll or not help you when it comes into play. So there are other modifiers, but the basic is Lucky 13. Well, I have one other thing to mention on
sure,
that system.
Totally.
Since Mr. Carpio developed it, he is also talking to TSR about, a new game system using the same game engine.
Okay.
And it has to do with Pulp Era, I believe is the working title, Pulp Era.
Sir, you are still singing our song.
Well, the Pulp Era is his world, not my world. And it's very funny. Pulp Era is the 30s, 40s radio. Yeah, early
right.
TV back in then, 50s. And Top Secret is contemporary now. And the one thing we don't use is the word future.
Mm-hmm.
Our technology that the secret agents use can be on the cutting edge of reality, but this is not standard issue equipment for civilians, and you usually have to give it back after the mission. So
right.
We're not science fiction, but we're right on the edge of what's available today in the espionage world.
Gotcha.
I came up with a fun one for North Texas role-playing game convention. I found out for $499.95, you can get a diving knife with this compressed CO2 canister in the handle.
Mm.
And if you stab an aggressive shark, you can push a button and it releases the compressed CO2 into the shark, which freezes his organs so he doesn't bleed and inflates the shark so he goes to the surface. Well, this is a handy little tool for a secret agent. And it's reality.
That's a shark inflator.
And during the mission we played at North Texas, a guy was attacked by an alligator, and he used it successfully. And now it's being called the Inflatigator.
Of course.
Isn't that how James Bond killed Yaphet Kotto in Live and Let Die? Didn't he inflate him?
I think so.
There was one where they inflated a couch, I know, with some bullet in one of the Bond films. But I'm sorry, I've digressed.
Oh, not at all.
No, this is all stuff we definitely wanted to talk about.
Not at all.
What were you doing all those years in between, and how did this project come about?
Well, I had to earn a living. I looked at staying in the game industry, and I wrote to a lot of the game companies at the time. TSR was the man on top at the time.
Right.
They didn't want me. So I wrote to other companies, did some freelance work for some of the companies. You may see some of my work, but it was feast or famine. I either had too much work or no work as a game designer. So eventually I had to find a real job with a real paycheck and benefits. So nowadays I manage a database for a major Midwestern convenience store chain. I'm also their archivist, but I won't name them.
Okay.
Anyway, they're big and they're coming to your state. Anyway, because I was working there, after 30 years, after I was downsized, I get a call from not only from Jason Elliott to write for his magazine. It was 2014, March, and I get a call from Luke Gygax, said, "Hey, Merle, why don't you come be a guest here at GaryCon in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin?" And I also got a call from Harold Johnson, who's once been my supervisor. He wanted me to be at Nexus, first Nexus, at Milwaukee.
Uh-huh.
So suddenly I'm coming out of the cold. I get to GaryCon and meeting people and reacquainting myself. And Jason Elliott says at that convention, or maybe a few calls before that, "Would you consider writing a new 21st century espionage game?" I thought about it. I said, "Sure, if I can get the original editor, because Alan Hammack made my work better." So Mr. Elliott contacted Mr. Hammack, who also had a real job by this time. He's been in the business. I've been in my employer for 28 and a half years. He's been about the same with his employer. And he said, yeah, he'd edit it. So then I pulled out all my unpublished work that was espionage related and started assembling it using the table of contents from the original game, just so I'd have the, you know, you create the character and then you arm the character. There's a certain flow to the game. So I started looking at what rules already existed and what needed to be new and invented. Discovered I had a manuscript from a campaign that Mike Carr had started, and how much it cost to build a headquarters. And so I asked Mike if I could buy it from him, and he said, sure. And so that actually is on the cutting room floor right now. We didn't use it.
No.
So I was getting contributions from people, including Chad Parrish contributed the technical intelligence and the signal intelligence and the human intelligence, those tradecraft skills. I said, can I use these? He said, it would be an honor. So I stole them, which is where a lot of our tradecraft came from. It started in 2014. It developed 2015, 2016. We were playtesting a fake version called Codename Acrid Herald, because we didn't want anybody to know the name was going to be Top Secret New World Order. They applied for trademark protection, copyright. They knew they had TSR. Now they needed to protect Top Secret New World Order as a title, and they did. And they, Jason Elliott did. We wanted to keep a lid on it while we were at conventions from the East Coast to the West Coast. I was playing in, I was playing at Nexus. I was playing at GaryCon. I got invited down in North Texas role-playing games in Dallas-Fort Worth. Ran into Alex Kamrar, who invited me to come to Game Hole in Madison, Wisconsin, in, I believe, November that year. So I suddenly was back in the circuit. I got people from the Quad Cities, which is up here between Iowa and Illinois, wanted me at their convention. I crashed a convention in Omaha where, let me see, it was called NukeCon, and Jolly Blackburn from Kinzer and Company was there, and he said, come on in, you know, sit at my table. You know, he is also a fan of my game. I'm a fan of his Aces and Eights. Where else did I crash? Anyway, the point is, people were very interested. When we got to the point of playtesting with live players, we thought we needed 17, 18 playtest groups. So Jason put it out on the internet, we needed playtesters for Acrid Herald. Over 100 people applied. He had to turn off the request after 100-some people applied to be game masters.
Wow.
And we sent them a PDF of the rules and let them play. We had a sample module, and I believe it was White Queen. And we got feedback from lots and lots of people, and they were thrilled. They were absolutely thrilled. Now, keep in mind that younger gamers want larger weapons. Older gamers want sneaky gadgets, and the types of playing younger people tend to shoot at everything that moves. Older people tend to sneak around and are more, they're secret. They live longer that way.
What's that old adage about age and treachery beat youth and beauty?
Yes, it's very true. The other phenomenon, and I'll mention this at risk, I showed up at conventions and Jim Ward said, "Merle, you ought to try a women's only game." And I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, it works. The women are not intimidated by the men. They want to play the games. They want to know how they work. So you should play some top secret that's women only." So I tried it, and I immediately filled the table. I had six uh-huh. to eight women sitting at my table at GaryCon, and they loved it. Absolutely, it didn't matter that it was a role-playing game. It was a spy game. And I will say men and women both like shopping and bargain hunting, trying to get equipment for the mission. I'd also say that men and women have different problem-solving skills, equally valid. And I will say women are more compassionate to their fellow players, and women applaud when things are done well. So from a 30-year hiatus, I suddenly had women sitting at my table, and I'd rarely seen women playing the original game. It was a male-dominated hobby, and now we have women. I have a mother and daughters coming to see me whenever I'm in Milwaukee or Lake Geneva. They want to play my game. I have other women at other conventions. Oh, Wichita. I went to Wichita, and there were women gamers at my event, and they loved it.
I myself, as a woman gamer, have only realized recently just how many of us there are.
Well, you've come a long way, baby, from the old, from 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't see women at game convention. And now, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's much improved. Let's put it that way. And it's high time. It's high time.
As you go about your design and playtesting, have you noticed anything that's changed in terms of people's expectations, either in as far as the gaming experience or what they expect out of a spy adventure these days?
I will tell you that Jason Bourne has some effect. A lot of Jason Bourne characters are killing machines, you know, kill first, ask questions later. So Jason Bourne also is into using his vehicle as a weapon. So what we did, Jason Elliott wrote a bunch of, I will call it, automobile combat rules. And so we have a whole section on how to use not only 20 vehicle sheets, 48 hazard markers, so we can have some combat between vehicles. And it's a pretty good system. So that was Jason Elliott's contribution. So a lot of interplay of vehicles going on. I was asked to write a lot of underwater combat rules. We have modern weapons now that can shoot underwater, and they can shoot special ammunition from regular weapons that goes underwater. So that's another section we've increased on. Oh, yes, you might have heard of the drone. We have drones in this game, lots and lots of them, above water, underwater, amphibious drones. Drones are our friend. Drones are a new thing in our technology. We also run into things like a universal translator for your cell phone, because as you know, in the real world, you can take a picture of a foreign language and the computers will translate it for you.
Uh-huh.
And you can speak into a device and it will translate for you. Uh-huh. Kind of useful information that your handheld device can interpret for you.
Oh, yeah.
So now we have the internet, we have cell phones. And a little thing that I put in the game was non-lethal weapons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean weapons that will knock you down and not kill you. And we've discovered it is far more interesting role-playing. Oh, in addition to the non-lethal weapons, first aid rules. What happens with a tourniquet? What happens with a adhesive that seals the wound? What happens with devices that suck up the blood and clot the shotgun blast? These are real-world things. Well, suddenly, role-playing is not you get shot and you die, which is reality. In the game, the guns are so lethal, we needed to counteract that. So we started using a lot of first aid, a lot of fortune points to survive, and also non-lethal weapons to knock people down, to injure them. but not to kill them and knock them out of the gameplay. There's some balance. You have to have balance with the modern game because weapons are so lethal. And how do you do that? You don't make the weapons less lethal. You give the survivability increase through non-lethal weapons. Oh, armor. There's all kinds of new ballistic cloth and ceramic plate and armor on vehicles. There's all kinds of things that are modifying the effectiveness of modern weapons.
Gotcha.
Be aware. These things are new and we're using them. Well, the Agents of Cool is a clever name, Agents of Cool.
Thank you.
And Thank you very much.
I looked at your website and I went, really? This is all movies and TV. However, I have written for, years ago, there was a spy club at one of the universities, and I wrote for their magazine. And I'm trying to remember who it was, but there's some crossover sometimes, and you go,
yeah. Yeah, we've been doing movies and TV up to now, but we're looking forward to doing something with the various spy RPGs, and this was definitely a chance to do that. Thank you very much again for...
And we're also going to be branching out into your spy-based comic books. I mean, there's your classic Jim Steranko, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff. And I know Dynamite Comics has done just a bang-up job with the James Bond license the last year and a half or so.
Well, I'll tell you what's fascinating about the James Bond game. Top Secret had a 3-year head start on the first James Bond role-playing game.
Right.
And people asked me, there was a Q manual that produced all of the James Bond weapons and vehicles, et cetera. Somebody asked me, well, what do you think of the Q manual? I said, best supplement ever produced for Top Secret, because that's what people were doing. They were playing my game, but they were taking the weapons and the gadgets out of the Q manual. Well, eventually, TSR produced the Top Secret Companion, and then when they did Top Secret SI, they asked me to do Guns, Gadgets, and Getaway Gear.
Oh, did write that.
Yes, yes.
Excellent.
I think I worked with my wife, Jackie. She's my co-author.
Uh-huh.
She's better qualified as a writer than I am. She has the education. But the funny part is, I've already been spoken to by Jason Elliott, the publisher of this new TSR Top Secret New World Order. He wants to know, what else do you got? What I've talked to Alan Hammack about is cutting room floor. All the stuff that didn't fit in the original 128 pages. I've also introduced secret societies, personal secrets, secret talents. He wants real world agencies like the NSA, no such agency.
Right.
He wants those put in the game. And the Inflatigator. All the neat gadgets that keep popping up. You see them in movies. You see them in real life. I only have to open the Time magazine or the newspaper, and it's filled with espionage. You may notice that.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of that going around these days.
One other funny thing. I mentioned Mike Carr, who is famous for Fight in the Skies, which became Dawn Patrol. Mike Carr had an awful lot to do with, like, Player's Guide, Player's Handbook. He sends me clippings, espionage clippings from, say, the Wall Street Journal. And he's been doing that for years. He just keeps sending me clippings. He'll save up, you know, a dozen clippings, and he'll send me an envelope full. So I keep getting stuff from people. I can't slow down my brain. Well, yeah, I can. I fall asleep at night. But the point is, new ideas, we got a lot of them. Also, we are encouraging people to contact TSR with your ideas, not just for supplements, but for mission modules. We think we're going to be producing a lot of material. I've been asked to do a mini module. Mine's going to take place in Soho, a part of London, and I can give you this much. We've already play tested it at a couple conventions. Basically, MI5 has swapped two briefcases, one a slow death special, which was meant for a gun runner, and the other is a plan for peace in the Middle East. And the two, which is for a ambassador, and the two briefcases got swapped, and your mission is to swap them back to the correct recipient.
Oh, that's
well,
that
would be
what
important.
Could possibly go wrong? London is highly covered in surveillance at every street corner.
Yes.
closed circuit television, and they have roving security vans, unmarked vans up and down the street, and they have drones that can follow you down the street and watch your movements. Welcome to modern London. You also have paparazzi. I hope to use the paparazzi as the foils of this. Oh, yes, you have to have a bad guy. So I've invented a Iratian. Iratia is a country that sent this arms dealer to London, and he got the wrong briefcase. Instead of killing him, they've given him a peace plan, and he's furious. So all these, this little plot line, is I've been asked to work it into a, well, I call them a mission module, which we're going to give to some of our backers. We did a bunch of not just playtest people, but, oh, we gave them a bookmark with a code on it. And if they send in their code, they're going to qualify for Merle Rasmussen's London Blitz mission module.
Excellent.
It's half written. It's playtested. Now I have to put it in English. So that's, or British, as the case may be. I actually asked a Anglophile some of the terms, and he looked at it and he said, well, like cheesed off, if you're really perturbed at someone. There's phrasing that he said the British are deliberately polite. And so that's kind of fun to play with that. Britishisms for flavor, put that in the game. Also, the city is just jam-packed, heavily populated. We're not in an exotic locale. I generally play in the Sahara Desert or in the world's largest swamp south of the Amazon rainforest or in the Cambodian jungle. I'm always going to exotic places where your cell phone doesn't work. I've been playtesting those three modules for several years now, having to do with Sahara, Cambodia, and the world's largest swamp called the Pantanal down there in Bolivia, Brazil. It's a swamp the size of Wyoming 6 months of the year.
Wow.
So, lends itself to hiding things. Go ahead and fire away with a couple questions.
Well, okay. You've actually answered a lot of what we had prepared. Now, I'm curious, the Kickstarter has been really successful here, but it's still early days. We were curious if you guys had any exciting stretch goals you'd like to preview for us.
We chose not to do stretch goals for the purpose we want to concentrate on the basics first. It's sort of like the Barbie doll. You get the Barbie and then you buy all the accessories.
Sure.
Well, rather than tempt you, I will just say I want to have a black baseball cap with the name of the game on it. There's only six in the world right now for Top Secret New World Order. They embroidered six baseball caps and gave them to us at GaryCon. I love this thing. I had people offer me money for it, you know. And it's so simple, but it makes me look like I'm on a hit team or something. Other guys don't want to wear it because it messes their hair. But the point is, as a team, we look pretty cool wearing these jet black baseball caps and with the name of the game on the front. And I thought, you got to sell these. These are really cool.
Oh, yeah.
And they said, we got to do mission modules first. We got to do other things, accessories. I said, I understand. Well, then somebody said, you got to have sunglasses, top secret sunglasses. And I'm going, okay, that's a clever idea, but then no one will recognize us, and I want to be recognized. So there's a lot of back-channel talk about what to do next.
Gotcha.
Somebody suggested that we get ourselves hooked up with a miniatures company and produce Top Secret New World Order miniatures. Mm. And I don't know what scale we would use, but it lends itself to playing with miniatures. I introduced playing with Lego building blocks, and I even wrote a piece on using Lego. Goodman Games paid me to, there were 25 authors, and Goodman Games published How to Write Adventure Modules That Don't Suck.
Oh,
well,
yes.
It's 160 pages long. I'm in it. I'm using Lego, and I wrote an adventure for fantasy called Shipwrecked on Lego Island. I haven't written fantasy in a while, but Joe Goodman said, Merle, you have an interesting take on fantasy. Well, I've been using Lego for about 2 years at conventions and letting the gamers build the environment that the mission is going to occur in. If it's an Incan ruin, they have to build the Incan ruin around my central pyramid or temple. Or if it's ruins in the Sahara, pre-Egyptian ruins of a trading city somewhere in Chad. And people love this, to build with Lego, and then we have to scale. They're a one-stud brick as an agent, and then this entire construction is all to scale, and you can see sight lines, and they put a sniper on the highest point and see where he can shoot to, and he can look over walls if you build a giant sphinx. And people love 20 to 30 minutes of game time just building with Lego.
That is amazing. I would never have thought about that. And you cannot see what my husband looks like right now, but he buys like aquarium decorations to use for miniatures games. So,
yep.
So when you're talking about the using of miniatures with the role playing, I'm not going to call his name, but it's Ray over here, who's like really just, he's already a huge supporter of that idea.
Thumbs up.
I like the aquarium items. I saved some columns one time because I like what they were doing. Wanted to tell you guys another thing I do, which is a prop, and I almost wrote about it. For a top secret adventure, of course, you're issued certain standard equipment, like you're all plugged into an ear comm so you can hear each other talk, and throat mics all on the same channel. And you issue everybody a standard weapon so they can defend themselves. And then people go to trading posts and they trade their sunglasses for other equipment, illicit or not, that they're going to use in the mission. I have a little game at conventions called Keep It or Pass It, like a game show. And I have about 8 different props that I bring to the table. For example, I have a 4.8 ounces of plastic explosive, which is actually silly putty. And I pass it to the guy on the right and I say, keep it or pass it. And he's got to decide he's going to get one special device, keep it or pass it. So the next item is a sack of gold, little pyrite, iron pyrite. Keep it or pass it. And then I'll have a sack of uncut diamonds, plastic. Pass that along. Keep it or pass it. So I have all these things from dinosaur fossils to an ounce of uranium-235 to animal feed to, you get the idea. And people at the table are loving this because their agent, often because of who the agent is, will say, well, I've got to have that. I need the demolition. I need the plastic explosive and the detonator because I'm the demolitions expert, you know, that kind of thing. And others will say, oh, that particular antique beheading sword, I'm an assassin, so I'm going to use that, an antique beheading sword that's shaped like a scimitar. It's actually a roofing nail that's been hammered into the shape of a scimitar. But
awesome.
This is a little prop called Keep It or Pass It, and people love it at conventions.
Another one I would not have thought of, but it sounds very interesting.
Well, they also laugh because how would we ever use this stuff in a mission? They can't figure it out till they're in the mission. And then they can be very, as you know, character agents do what you don't plan. They combine my 1 ounce of uranium-235 with the plastic explosive and produced a dirty bomb, which then radiated the bad guy's hideout, so he couldn't use it for 1,000 years. So, you know, things like that happen during the mission.
Well, that was always the great thing about, you know, the opening to Mission Impossible is, you know, there's like an inflatable life raft, a rose, and a clown nose, and they're like, yep, all right, and then you'll get the clown nose. Okay, great. And the viewer is just sort of trying to figure out, what in the heck is all this going to be used for? And they spend the next hour watching just to pay off, how does all these random bits and bobs turn into a plan? Which was, you know, that was part of the appeal of the show.
I think your favorite one was the one where in the opening montage, you see Jim Phelps in a monk's robe rolling a wheel of cheese.
Yes. That's
like, how is this possibly going to work into
the
show?
And you will sit there for a solid hour just to find out what that happens. So yeah, that captures that just beautifully. It's like a scimitar, a bag of gold. I love that.
That's actually really, really good for this game. That's perfect.
I wanted to tell you, the idea wasn't mine originally. You know, I stole the women-only game from Jim Ward. Frank Mentzer said, Merle, you got to do an ad-lib mission. I said, what's that? He said, have your gamers write down one thing they want to see during the game and then work it into the plot somewhere. And I tried it once, maybe twice, got too confused, put it aside because they wanted jetpacks and atomic bombs and things that just didn't fit with the plot. So then I came up with the idea of ad-lib the keep it or pass it small devices. I'll give you one. I had a stack of play money, $50,000 to $2 million in play money, and I handed it to a teenager. And he said, I'm keeping it. Do I have to get on the plane with the other agents? I said, yes. That's a thing in that you're taking this money on the mission, so you'll have cash. And he held on to this stack of play money for like 4 hours for the entire game as if it were real money. And I couldn't believe he was role-playing it that strongly. He wouldn't let it out of his hand. And people laugh when I pull out a pair of handcuffs. I have a pair of handcuffs that gets laughs, and they're fake. You know, they're fake children's handcuffs, but people really get a giggle out of handcuffs, and they use them. You know, they use the handcuffs on each other at the game, but also their agent uses them. So all these little props from real life, of course, I don't use real gold and real diamonds, but right. The players understand this is my agent's special device, and I can use it during play. And they do. They improvise. They figure out a way to include these strange items.
Well, we're totally stealing that idea.
Oh, yeah.
You like that?
We like it.
Well, my dinosaur bones are like from a dead squirrel, and I had a wolf's tooth.
A very tiny dinosaur.
Weirdly shaped rock, you know, and I put it in a little plastic Ziploc bag and said, dinosaur bones. Well, what is this worth? I said, well, it's worth tens of thousands of dollars to a museum in the West. Really? Oh, okay. And they keep the dinosaur bones. I mean, just a sack of old bones. But some kids freak out. They don't want to touch it. It's too real. It's realistic. Mm. It's fun. Yeah, I'm having fun with it. They don't know what things are. But I had a prop. I picked up a plastic ounce of uranium-235 at the Nebraska State Fair when I was a kid, which is equivalent to 100 tons of coal. They were showing the value of uranium. Mm-hmm. And I kept the thing, and now I put it in a little stack, and I say, okay, here's a 1 ounce of uranium-235, and their eyes light up because they know it's valuable to the wrong people during the mission. So it's kind of fun prop. Fire away with another question unless you have run out of questions.
I think we've covered just about everything that we wanted to. Do you guys have anything?
Well, I think I speak for all of us when I say we are super excited for this new game. And after we get our hands on this thing, we're going to be running out on everybody we can get to sit still for it. This material is really right in our wheelhouse, and we are tremendously excited about this. So thank you so much for your time tonight.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm supposed to inform you to look up topsecretnwo.com, which will link you to our Kickstarter, or just go to the Kickstarter somehow. Anyway, the point is, we are very pleased with the Kickstart program.
Oh, yes.
I've got the conference call on Saturday. Something's going on. I need to call the publisher tonight. People want to talk to me, and we're having a hi-ho time. We're enjoying it.
All right.
Excellent.
Outstanding, sir. Thank you very much for your time, and good luck with, I want to say good luck with the Kickstarter, but it's already going gangbusters. So, but continue.
Different game.
Yeah, good luck with the Kickstarter.
It's a different game system entirely. although I was at TSR when Gangbusters was being developed. Yeah, that's very odd. Perhaps another episode of Agents of Cool, we can talk about what I did and didn't help develop when I worked at TSR.
Well, I tell you what, after the Kickstarter is over and things proceed, we'll arrange another interview with you and see how things are going. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, you guys have a fun time, and thank you for your interest. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
And good night, all.
Good night.
Good night, sir.
As a listener of this show, you are entertained by the same kinds of spy movies that we are, and this exciting new game system sounds like the perfect thing to execute these kinds of missions around your gaming table. The Kickstarter has already started as of this recording. It's going gangbusters. It's already funded. This is a real thing. It's not really a risk for you. This is going to happen. This game is going to be a real thing. And you should go right now tonight to www.topsecretnwo.com. On that page is a link that's going to take you to the Kickstarter itself. You're going to want to get in on this. This is going to be a good game, and you're going to freaking love playing this game. You can thank us later. The thing funded within 8 minutes, and there's still a couple of 3 weeks to go. You want to get in on this. Thank you for listening to this first episode of Agents of Cool Debrief. I am Eric, your grumpy number six My email address is number 6, all lowercase letters, at agentsof.cool.
I am Ray at agentsof.cool.
I am Stacey and can be reached at Mrs. Peel, MRSPEEL, no period, at agentsof.cool.
Again, thank you so much for listening. Please find us on Twitter @Ray.
@agentsofcool.
Please find our website, Stacy, at
agentsof.cool.
Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back soon.
If we've been ranting about a superhero movie for the past 15 minutes, we're probably done with the spy portion of the podcast and should hit the stop button and go get dinner. So,
yeah.